I want to thank you all so much for coming. And I want to tell you that it's a little crowded. You feel a little crowded here. I think we have most of our seats filled, a few people standing. And that has been the experience that Bob and I have had at every stop so far on this tour. In Portland, in Seattle, in San Francisco, in Western Massachusetts, out in the Middle West. And it tells us something that, you know, look, we're not romantic about ourselves. We're quite well aware that, you know, it's not probably all related to our looks. It may not even be related to the work that we've done. We have a feeling that it is deeply rooted in the fact that people across this country really do care about journalism and democracy. And it is our purpose to assure that in the 21st century, this country has a media as robust and as vital as the media that we had at the start of the Republic. And we'll tell you a little bit about how to do that. But first off, I do want to recognize some folks who are with us tonight, and you'll understand why I recognize them up front, because so much of our story comes around to them. We're joined this evening by Jason Pramus, I hope I say your last name right, Jason, who's editor and publisher of openmediaboston.org, www.openmediaboston.org. Along with, and this is what we really like when you bring your whole cast and crew with you, Anna, Diana, Elizabeth, Dave, and Jesse from openmediaboston.org, a whole newsroom, the newsroom right here with us. And yes, applaud them and thank them, because these people are not waiting to be told what our next media system will be. They're building it. And all of what we're about is saying that there's very little to mourn in the passing of old media. There is much to celebrate in the arrival of a new and better media than we have known in our lifetimes. But we must understand the crisis that is collapsing old media and the responsibility that goes with building new media. So, how do we do that? Well, I will tell you, I really want to reassure you, Bob is coming. And his job is to be the optimist and the happy guy. My job is to really bum you out. And I have said in other settings, I think you look like such a sane and rational group of people that we won't actually do the collection of razor blades and sharp objects prior to the talk. But I'm going to talk for a few minutes about the crisis of media. And the crisis of old media right now is about as depressing and dark as you can imagine. But I want to begin it to frame out our comments tonight and really to frame the book out. There's a British journal called History Today. And the slogan of that magazine is, "What happened then matters now." What happened then matters now. And in a real sense, that's what this book is about. Our subtitle, "The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again," is, for those of you who've studied any American history, stolen from Tom Paine. Tom Paine, in his wonderful essays at the beginning of the American Revolution, said, "We have it in our power to begin the world again." He did not say that to people to make them feel good. Nor did he say it to them as a rhetorical flourish. He said it as a call to action. He said, your responsibility, your challenge is so great because you must live beyond yourself. What you need to do is more important than you. You're not talking about freeing this country from the yoke of colonial empire. You are talking about setting an example that will bring freedom to places that did not even understand the meaning of the word. Such a radical revolutionary moment that was 1776. It is our argument that we live in an equally revolutionary moment today, unfortunately, most of our political class and most of our media class doesn't understand it. They are very, very busy whining and whinging about how bad things are. And we think of them as the Tories of the current moment, saying, well, yes, of course, King George is a bad guy, but do we really want to get him mad at us? I mean, let's not go and dump that tea in the harbor. And I would remind you, little political interjection here, I do write for The Nation magazine. The people who threw the tea in the harbor in Boston were radical critics of imperialism and corporate power, not a bunch of people who were whining about getting too much health care. So, we're going to speak tonight about journalism and democracy. And it is important to understand that when we speak of journalism and democracy, we are speaking of two topics that were incredibly close to the heart of our friend Howard Zinn. And Howard, who gave us a nice blurb for this book and collaborated with us on a lot of projects over the years. And if you go and get, this is, I swear, I will brag about nothing else tonight. But if you go up and get the last edition of The People's History of the United States on page, heaven knows, I don't know why I know this, page 673, it's the second one on the page. You will find that that he quotes an article I wrote from, and in fact references some of the work that I did. And it's like, you know, that's enough. I'll retire, right? To have been noted by Howard Zinn in any way. But the reason I bring up Howard Zinn right now is because it's so apropos of the discussion that we're here to have. Howard Zinn taught us how to use history, and this book is a book of history, as well as examination of the current moment. This book takes us back to the founding of the Republic and through a lot of journalism, not boring history. This is the history of revolutions and dangerous actions and post offices that were burned because they delivered abolitionist papers and people who struggled for a free press at the expense of their own lives because it was so important to the democratic experiment. But Howard taught us how to energize and engage with history. And he had a series of ways that you look at it. And I think it's valuable to what we're doing. He said, first and foremost, do not allow yourself to be weighted down by the transitory fights of the moment. Don't get wrapped up in a particular issue or struggle of this second, so much so that you miss the broad structures, the broad challenges, the broad issues that define society. If you're always worried about one small issue in one small moment, or one small frustration, or even one challenge, you miss the reality that is beyond you. And you also lose sight of the opportunities that exist, especially in a time of crisis. The second thing he said is you must always be rigorous in your examinations of proposed reforms. And this is a really important thing. It's one of the things that we do in the book. We look at all of the mainstream and even many of the radical ideas about how to develop a journalism in the 21st century. We don't say, oh, we've got all the answers. We literally go structurally through a lot of different ideas, and we do so because we want to see something that might work. Unfortunately, what we come up with is based in the data, based in the research, that almost all of the proposals for saving journalism will not work. Not only won't they work, they will all often make things dramatically worse. And so the people who are out there telling you, for instance, as Rupert Murdoch, who's literally one of the most foolish people on the planet, Rupert Murdoch is saying, well, we know how to save journalism. We're going to put a big fence around it and make people pay to get through, defeating the entire wisdom of the internet. All of the ideas for how we might have a free and open dialogue, we're going to block that out with paywalls, and we're going to make it hard for people to leap from one article to another and actually track something down and do anything on their own. They're going to have to pay to come to the Wall Street Journal site. That's the genius, frankly, of the current dialogue in mainstream media. Make people pay. Or live in the fantasy that somehow advertising is going to come back to mainstream media. No, it has fled. Bob Garfield, the great historian of American advertising, the writer for Ad Age and other publications for many years, hosts On the Media, just did a book a while back. We rely on it in many sections of what we do. His book is called Chaos, because he says there will never, ever be an advertising-sustained journalism again. It's gone. It's over. It's not coming back. This is an expert in advertising who likes advertising, who wants to see advertising. And he's saying, it's gone and it's not coming back. And if you want confirmation of it, look in the Financial Times today. I always read the financial press. It always tells you what's really going on because they cannot lie to each other. But they also don't put it on the front page. You got to go deep inside. There's a big story today. Pepsi, you've heard of them. Pepsi's not going to advertise on the Super Bowl this year. They've advertised always on the Super Bowl. They're not going to do it this year because they're putting the money, the $20 million that they would have put in Super Bowl ads, into Facebook. They're going online directly to people rather than trying to go via an existing media platform. What that means, as you play that out, corporation by corporation, advertiser by advertiser, is that it's disappearing. The money that would sustain journalism is going, and it is never coming back. I can't emphasize, it's going away. So be rigorous in your study of the data. Figure out the reality, not the fantasy that might make you feel good for another year as the decline continues. The third thing that Zinn taught, and absolutely essential in all this, is ground your radical proposals, your real proposals for repair, in an understanding of the current crisis, but also in an understanding of American history. Know what has come before. Know what has come before because it inspires people to understand what can be done now. Nothing that has been done is impossible to do again. And it is so very vital that people realize in America, we have had journalism crises before and we've resolved them. In fact, we'll go even further. We'll tell you that the current crisis in journalism, current crisis with media, is an easily resolved crisis. That we have historical models, we have models from other countries that will guide us through this very, very easily. All we have to do is break through a lot of fantasies and falsehoods. The final thing that Zinn taught was, don't figure these things out and go and speak merely to a group of academics. Don't go and speak to a group of elites. Ground your repairs for small-d democratic and societal crises in a dialogue with the great mass of Americans. Go out and talk to people in their union halls, in their churches, in their community centers about how they can be actively involved in repairing a breach in the system. Don't simply look for some sort of elite fix that will be handed down from on high, because in this country, the elite fixes handed down from on high have brought us to the crisis where we currently find ourselves. Remember, most of our media system is defined by government policy. We have airwaves owned by the people with licenses given for free to major broadcasters, right? A license to print money. We have given the corporate class every opportunity to become incredibly rich, and they are blowing it. Things that a trained orangutan could get right, they're getting wrong. And let me tell you just how wrong it is. Our book has a lot of personal stories, human stories, about people who want to be journalists. We begin with a young woman named Kate Jamarisi. Kate's exactly the kind of person that you want in journalism. Working class kid from Erie, Pennsylvania. She went to a decent school, studied journalism, worked on the college paper, volunteered in the on community newspapers and projects, got her clips, interned, did it all. She was, in fact, my intern at a newspaper in Wisconsin. And Kate went out and did exactly what we told her to do 10 years ago. She got a job on a small regional daily in Chillicothe, Ohio. And you know what? Not everybody goes to Chillicothe for the fun. She went there because she wanted to do journalism, and she did a good job. And then she got a job in Lorain, Ohio, at a bigger paper. And then she went to the Toledo Blade, a paper that's won the Pulitzer Prize twice. And she was moving up the media food chain, and she was working like you wouldn't believe. She's exactly the journalist you want there. When she got to Toledo, she said, you know, this town's hitting hard times economically, and so we want to step in to cover the people that are suffering. And so the first thing she did was go and sleep under bridges in Toledo with homeless folks. Now, not every senior journalist who's been at it for 25 years is volunteering to go and sleep with the homeless. Kate went out and did it. She then went out and lived for weeks on food stamps. She did all sorts of things. Went out and spent her time with kids who were not getting adequate access to education and transportation. She told all these stories of the people who were falling through the cracks at the early stages of the current economic recession. If you talk to Kate Giammarisi 3 years ago, you knew where our economic troubles were heading. You knew how they were developing. And she was doing such a great job. Her stories were being quoted in debates in Congress. She was winning awards. It was going great. And on December 13th of 2008, Kate emailed me and said, I just got the word. They're doing layoffs. And I'm going to lose my job. Pretty sure. She wasn't positive, but she thought pretty sure she would lose her job. And 2 weeks later, she sent me an email telling about how on the day after Christmas, she cleared her desk off, put everything in the desk, turned her computer off the last time, and left. Kate didn't want to give up on journalism. And so she and another laid-off reporter started a blog called Rustwire, covering the urban communities of the upper Midwest that are suffering so many layoffs, so much decline. Their slogan for their blog was, "We have chosen not to leave." And their point was that these communities need journalism even if commercial media does not employ us to do the job. And they struggled to make their blog work, much as the Open Media Boston folks are doing now. And they couldn't do it economically. The blog was fabulous. The work they did online was great, but it didn't work economically. And Kate finally, after 6 months of literally living hand to mouth, took a job with a corporate trade publication. We lost her to journalism. Now, we might drag her back someday, but we lost a great journalist. And if she was the only story, that'd be one thing. But the fact of the matter is, every month for the last 2 years, American newspapers have laid off more than 1,000 employees. Most of them, the younger, brighter, newer reporters coming in. Last hired, first fired. We are losing a generation of our brightest, most engaged, and most passionate journalists. We are driving another generation away from the craft, telling them there are no jobs. And this decline is played out even more deeply in the reality that some newspapers are actually closing down. Last year, 140 newspapers across the United States closed down. Big newspapers in Seattle, in Denver, in Tucson, in Albuquerque. The newspaper in Ann Arbor, Michigan, a college town, closed down. It's gone. You had a great big dialogue here in Boston about the Boston Globe closing. One of the Detroit papers will close in the next year or so. The closing of major dailies is not a phenomenon that just was related to the economic recession, a slippage of advertising, nor was it related to the rise of the internet. One of the great fantasies is that the internet has driven this decline in journalism. But as we trace in the book, the decline in journalism can actually be found going on back 20 years ago. And it is related to a phenomenon that needs to be understood. The locally owned newspaper, like the locally owned radio station and television station, we hope that you've been following TV and radio closely enough to understand that they were lost a long time ago. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 led to a massive consolidation of radio ownership. We lost 20,000 on-air personalities between 1996 and today. Television news has seen an incredible contraction that is still going on, where local TV stations in major markets like Chicago, Cleveland, other places, I'll give you an example, the Fox News affiliate on a major good channel in Chicago, covering the whole city of Chicago, all of its metro area, better part of 4 million people, has 6 reporters. The fact is, television news is not doing journalism to cover a community. It's not doing state house or national reporting, even in a sense. What it's doing is a lot of weather. 6-7 minutes of weather. They will tell you in Boston, you watch your news tonight, they will tell you that it was 30 degrees in Boston and 31 in Cambridge. That will be your news. So TV, radio off the chart, but the decline of the newspaper newsroom going on now in a genteel way for the better part of 20 years, long before the internet, now accelerating at this incredibly rapid rate as the corporate model crumbles. And why did it crumble? Because chain ownership came in. Outside owners bought local papers. They bought them for much more than they could afford. They have to service huge debt, and they have investors who want a 30 to 40% profit. It does not work. You have to squeeze somewhere. Where do you squeeze? Well, after you've laid off enough delivery drivers and advertising folks and everybody else, you go into the newsroom and you start laying off journalists. 1,000 journalists and newspaper workers a month, every month for the last 2 years. More than 30,000 jobs shed. The American Society of Newspaper Editors tells us we have in the United States 46,000 daily newspaper reporters. Now, and editors. Now, do the math. If you're losing 1,000 a month, and let's say they're not all journalists, some of them doing other work, but let's say half of them are. At that rate, we don't have a lot of time. The sense of urgency should be palpable. And the fact of the matter is, it is. There's a palpable urgency in the media. Bob and I have been writing about media issues for the better part of 15 years. The funny thing about this current tour, we've been covered in almost every daily newspaper in the community of Cambridge. This never happened before. The Boston Globe wrote about us today. The Seattle Times took an op-ed from us. Papers in Portland, all over the country, writing about what we're saying. They're not doing it because they like us. They're so scared they will listen to us. Microsoft bought 50 copies of our book for their researchers to look at because they're trying to figure out what's going to happen with content in this country, because we are seeing a deadening down, a dying of content production, of the production of the news that we need. And why does this matter? Well, as we say in the book and every place we go, our discussion is not about journalism or newspapers or media. Our discussion is about democracy, because a democracy cannot function unless the people are sufficiently informed to govern themselves. James Madison, critical author of the Constitution, said, "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power that knowledge gives." Knowledge is being cut off. And there is a fantasy that tells you that somehow the internet will fill the gap. And the internet is a wondrous tool. Bob and I have been blogging forever. I was blogging before they had the word blog. And I love it. I work on it every day. I did a blog this afternoon. Actually, very good news. Someone has introduced in Congress a constitutional amendment, proposed constitutional amendment to overturn the Citizens United decision, which will do so much to warp our politics. So the fact is, we love blogging. We love the internet, but the internet is not filling the void with this collapse of information. And I'll close with an example, because we can talk about the crisis, we can lay it out, but we need to bring it down to someplace where it's human, where we understand it. We understand Kate Jamarisi lost her job. But let's talk about what that means in a city that might make sense to us, in a city like Baltimore, Maryland. There's a new Pew study out where they looked at how all of the original news stories in Baltimore, Maryland, are generated. They studied the stories that came from the newspaper, from radio, from television, from blogs, from internet websites, from Twitter feeds, everything. They looked at every source of information, all the original news stories in town. Where do they come from? Pew found out that 96% of the original news stories were still generated by old media, by the newspaper, to a lesser extent, radio and television. Now, you think, well, pop the champagne corks. There's no crisis. Old media is doing the job. But then there's the footnote. Pew noted that the Baltimore Sun, the primary source of old media news stories in Baltimore, was producing 73% fewer stories than it produced in 1990. So in a 20-year period, a 73% drop in original news stories. So here's our, keep our facts going here. Old media producing most of the original news, going out and getting the stories, but they're doing 73% less of it. New media not filling the void. And here's the scary part, because those are statistics, but here's the statistic that tells you something. They studied where the original news stories came from. Who was the source of the news? Was it a citizen who said, look, I got a toxic waste dump down the street. Nobody's doing anything about it. Somebody's got to tell the story of it and then go up and use whatever authority they have to challenge the mayor, the governor, and others to address this issue. I'm a mom. My kids aren't getting a decent education. Somebody's got to tell the story of what's falling apart in our school and go up and demand of those in power that they respond to this crisis. That's journalism. That's why we have journalism. That's a speak truth to power journalism that power does not want spoken, does not the story that power does not want told. How many original news stories are coming in that way, up from some sort of grassroots, from some sort of human need? And how many stories are being fed down from above, are being given to us by power, by a CEO, by a governor, by a powerful figure who wants to define the dialogue and wants to constrain what we talk about? Where are the stories coming from? Well, with old media producing so much less, new media failing to fill the void, 86% of the stories in Baltimore came from power, 14% from anything that we might refer to as journalism. 86% public relations, spin. Now, you say, well, boy, bummer for Baltimore, right? I mean, it's too bad things are so bad there. In the book, we detail that in 1960 in the United States, there was one public relations person for every one journalist. In 1980, there was 1.2 public relations people for every journalist. They're still holding a relative equality there. Today, there are four public relations people, four people employed in doing public relations for every one journalist in America. We are making the transition, whether we want to admit it or not, whether we recognize it or not, from a place where we actually did have journalism, imperfect, frustrating, often wrong, but a journalism that tried, to a zone in which our information will be packaged and managed by power. This is a scenario that, frankly, if you had told George Orwell about it, Orwell would have said, hey, scrap the 1984 scenario. What a joke that is. I was imagining that Big Brother would be watching you. I didn't understand. You will be watching Big Brother. 24/7, round the clock, CNN, MSNBC, Fox. You know, you're going to have Rush Limbaugh on every radio station. You're going to have lots of media, lots of information, lots of weather, news on the 8s, weather on the 9s, news you can use. You're too fat. You need to go on a diet, right? But you're not going to have the information that you need as citizens to engage in the civic life of your community, to engage with your democracy. And that degeneration from a place of broad and healthy dialogue where all peoples had an opportunity to be a part of it, not just a wealthy elite that maybe had the ability to buy the information that it needed, a new monarchy. Not just those with the time to troll the internet for 6 or 7 hours looking for some kind of truth. But where all Americans had access, easy access to real information. This is an era that is passing. And if it passes without our intervention, we will not lose journalism, newspapers, or media. We will lose the democratic promise of this republic. That's what's at stake. Tom Paine wrote that a moment of crisis is the greatest moment of opportunity for a new republic. We would argue that this is still a new republic, that this moment of crisis is a 1776 moment. We have an opportunity to intervene aggressively as citizens to demand and to shape a media system that will sustain democracy. But if we fail to do so, we will not merely fail to begin the world again. We will fail this republic in the long term in ways that are truly unforgivable. This is a crisis moment. It is an opportunity moment. We need to be about the work of beginning the world again.